ערוץ 7.
Hello again, everybody. This is Jay Shapiro. This is the program for the week that starts on Sunday, the 2nd of June, which corresponds in the Hebrew calendar to the 28th day in the Hebrew month of Iyar. And today is Yom Yerushalayim. Today is Jerusalem Day. And this is the day when, back in 1967, the Israeli army captured the city of Jerusalem, returning Jerusalem to Jewish sovereignty after almost 2,000 years. And, of course, it is a celebration. There is a bit of a problem here in Israel that is not celebrated all over the country, which I think is a terrible blunder, but it is celebrated here in Jerusalem with special prayers, and people go with various tours, and they even have a special festive breakfast in some places, one of which I will be attending. So that is an important day in the Jewish calendar. And having said that, and having spoken about the capture of Judea and Samaria, known as the West Bank, I want to say a few words about our relationship with the Palestinians. And by the way, the West Bank, we have to use that word because that's how everybody refers to that area west of the Jordan River that Israel captured in the Six-Day War. To us, it is Judea and Samaria, but when you say that, people don't know what you're talking about. It became the West Bank when the Jordanians illegally conquered it back in 1948. According to UN resolution, there was supposed to be an Arab state and a Jewish state, and the city of Jerusalem was supposed to be internationalized. And what happened was the Jews said, fine, we will declare a Jewish state. And the Arabs made no attempt whatsoever. The Palestinian Arabs made no attempt whatsoever to set up a state. They waited for the other Arab armies to come in and get rid of the Jews. As a matter of fact, in many instances, they broadcast to the Palestinian Arabs they should leave and make room for the conquering armies. Then they'll come back. Most of them are in refugee camps. They've been there for 72 years. They're already the fourth and fifth generation, and they claim they want to come back, all of them. There are millions of them today. At the time of the war, when the number of Palestinian Arabs living west of the Jordan River was something somewhere between 500,000 and 700,000. Today, it's a lot of millions, and they want to come back. At least that's what they claim. So having said that, I want to say, now, what happened now, the situation I'm sure is familiar to the listeners, is the Gaza area, which Israel gave up in the Oslo Agreement, was taken over by, in a revolt, an armed revolt by Hamas and several other terrorist organizations, leaving the Palestinian Authority, which was supposed to rule in the Gaza area as well as in the West Bank. They're only in the West Bank because they were violently kicked out of the Gaza area by terrorist groups. They themselves are a terrorist group, but they wear business suits. So, and they also don't, they hide the fact that they're terrorists. They talk nicely, especially to Western diplomats. Hamas, on the other hand, makes no secret of its intentions to destroy the state of Israel. As a matter of fact, the fact that the Palestinian Authority remains in place in the West Bank is because it is protected by the Israeli army. There is no Israeli army in the Gaza area. Now, what I wanted to talk about is that in the past few days, the Gaza-based groups have issued several statements hinting that they would use all means, including terrorism, to foil the U.S. peace plan, which has not been announced yet. Trump said that when he came to visit here, he went and he prayed at the Western Wall. I have a picture of him with a skull cap. And he said, and I quote, he said, it's a tough deal, but we will get there. And the Arabs are doing all they can to see that there's no deal. What is perhaps more worrying for the Arab leaders are the threats coming from Iran's puppets. There is Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and Hezbollah. They are all puppets of Iran. So Iran is not only a danger to the whole area, not only is it in the process of perhaps getting nuclear weapons, which would be a danger to the entire world, but Hamas is also supporting these terrorist groups. Now remains to be seen whether the Arab heads of state will be deterred by these threats or ignore them at the risk of becoming the targets of Palestinian terrorism. Clearly, there's a conference that's supposed to come up in Bahrain, and the Palestinians are boycotting the conference. And clearly, the very Palestinians who are boycotting a conference whose aim is to help them move beyond their leadership-imposed economic devastation, and they'll wind up the big losers in the scenario of hate. This time, however, it also seems the Palestinians will not only deprive themselves of billions of dollars, but it will also damage, perhaps irrevocably, their relations with influential Arab countries. By all accounts, the Palestinians appear to be heading toward another catastrophe, which is the Arabic word. The Arabic word is Nakba. They refer to the creation of the State of Israel as the Nakba, and it looks like they're heading for another one. The Palestinians seem to be moving on several fronts in order to thwart U.S. President Donald Trump's plan for peace in the Middle East, which President Trump calls the deal of the century. It's interesting you should say that. We're only in the year 2019, so I'm not quite sure if he expects to be the biggest deal between now and 2099. Use of the word deal of the century, I seems a big exaggeration, but that's the way Trump talks. So what's happening is that the Palestinian Authority and its political allies in the West Bank have started a diplomatic and media campaign to rally worldwide support for the rejection of Trump's peace plan, even nobody has seen it yet. Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and other Palestinian extremist groups are already saying that they will resort to violence in an effort to thwart the deal of the century. Last week, Hamas, speaking about the upcoming conference in Bahrain, they announced they would not allow the Zionist enemy to defile its lands by attending the economic conference. So the Palestinians are going not to attend the conference, and it's going to be attended by major Arab nations here in this area, together with Israel. And according to the rumors, the so-called deal of the century is going to start with an economic solution, not a territorial solution. We understand the American administration is discussing how the Palestinians can be helped economically. So recently the Palestinians raised their attacks on this upcoming peace plan, which they haven't seen, particularly after the U.S. administration announced it will unveil the economic portion of the deal of the century at this economic workshop in Bahrain late in the month of June. The Palestinians have voiced strong opposition to the workshop, which they have nothing about. They say they'll boycott it, despite its goal of improving the living conditions of the residents of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. In other words, once again, keep in mind that the leadership of the Palestinians, it takes care of itself very well. They drive nice cars. They live in nice homes. They don't worry too much about the Arab man in the street. So in a rare show of unity, by the way, the president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, he has a faction called Fatah. He, by the way, is now in the 11th year of his four-year term. Gives an idea how democracy is faring under the Arabs. There's unity when Abbas and his rivals in Hamas and Islamic Jihad are saying that not only will the Palestinians boycott the conference, But all the countries invited should also reject the invitation to attend this workshop. The Palestinians are particularly focusing their effort on trying to persuade the Arab states to boycott the workshop. They're terrified, apparently, that the Arab countries will surrender to U.S. pressure and attend the conference. Thus, as the Palestinians see it, they'll abandon their Palestinian brothers, leaving them isolated in the international arena. Keep in mind that the Arab countries, like Saudi Arabia, are very worried about Iran, and they're using, apparently surreptitiously, Israeli support. Because Catholic is another thing, and people who are not familiar with this area don't realize about the religious things that go on here. The Saudi Arabians are Sunni Muslims, S-U-N-N-I, and the Iranians are Shiite Muslims, and they don't like each other particularly. So in addition to Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, the UAE, has said they will send delegates to the U.S.-led economic conference. Jordan, Egypt, and Qatar are expected to participate in the conference, notwithstanding this fierce opposition from the Palestinians. In other words, they're not taking the Palestinians into account. Last week, Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, traveled to Qatar and Jordan in a bid to persuade the two countries to join a Palestinian boycott of this workshop coming up in Bahrain. Apparently, according to the news reports, the most Abbas managed to get from Qatar and Jordan were the usual laconic statements of support for the Palestinian cause and Palestinian rights. His hope that Qatar and Jordan would publicly endorse the Palestinian boycott has failed to materialize. Even Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, the country hosting the conference, have made similar comments expressing full political support for the Palestinians while ignoring their call for boycotting the workshop. There's one thing about the Arabs. They've always excelled in paying lip service to the Palestinians, at the same time offering them very little in real support. These countries do what's best for them, and they don't really care about the Palestinians. And by the way, there's another thing about Palestinian society that people have to be aware of. The word, the spoken word, is very important to them. Their studies have been made of the way they what we would call exaggeration. They don't call exaggeration. They simply have a different attitude towards the spoken word. So you really can't trust what they say. So the Palestinians are really afraid of being abandoned by the other countries, and they're publicly trying to get the Arab states to boycott this economic workshop. And the whole idea of the economic workshop, as I understand it, is to help the Palestinians. The Palestinians have even gone as far as warning that participation in the workshop would be considered an act of treason, which is rather interesting that they would think that way. I mean, the whole idea is to help them, but they see it as an act of treason. So what's happening is that the leadership of the Palestinian Authority are trying political pressure to persuade the Arabs to boycott the conference, but other Palestinian groups seem to be preparing for a violent response to Trump's deal of the century. And the past few days, according to the newspaper reports, the Gaza-based groups have issued several statements hinting that they would use all means, including terrorism, to foil the U.S. peace plan. The head of the Islamic Jihad, the Secretary General, said last week that the Palestinians' resistance has enough power cards that would enable it to thwart the deal of the century. Although he did not provide details of what these power cards were, he was apparently referring to the possibility that Iran-backed Islam Jihad would resort to violence. saying they're going to resort to violence is sort of not news. I mean, that's all they do. Violence is what they do all the time. So the Islamic Jihad and Hamas, and they're working together with Hezbollah, which is the Iran's proxy terrorist group in Lebanon, to foil this conference and Trump's deal of the century. Last week, Hezbollah chief, a guy named Hassan Nasrallah, expressed strong opposition to the deal of the century, and he criticized anybody, essentially he threatened anybody who would go to the conference. Hard to imagine this terrorist group threatening countries like Saudi Arabia, but who knows? So the message that the Palestinians are sending to the Arab worlds is essentially either boycott the U.S. administration or we will incite the Arabs and the Muslims against you. Now, what's perhaps most worrying for the Arab leaders are the threats coming from Iran's puppets, which are Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and Hezbollah, because they are armed by Iran. So they could actually back up their threats and do violence against these Arab countries. So what remains to be seen right now is whether the heads of state of the Arab countries will be deterred by these threats or whether they ignore them at the risk of becoming the targets of Palestinian terror. So within the Muslim world, they have a lot of internal struggles, and there is a history of what they do to each other. So the question is, what will these heads of state, like Saudi Arabia, what will their attitude be toward the threats of the Palestinians? So the very Palestinians who are boycotting the conference, and keep in mind, the aim of the conference is to help them move beyond their economic devastation, which is imposed upon them by their leaders. Since the Oslo Agreement and they moved to Gaza, millions, if not billions of dollars have been poured into the area, and 50% of the people are without work. So the Palestinians will wind up the big losers in this spiteful scenario of hate. That's what it is. So this time, it seems that the Palestinians will not only deprive themselves of billions of dollars, but will also damage their relations with influential Arab countries. So by all accounts, it appears that the Palestinians may be heading toward another Nakba, another catastrophe. The Nakba of 1948, which was the creation of the State of Israel, was the big Nakba. But they could have made their own state at that time. They didn't. They ended up suffering a catastrophe. Now, if they don't behave properly vis-a-vis the Arab states with respect to this economic conference, they're going to have another Nakba. It seems the Arabs seem... I think it was Abba Ibn who said, the Arabs never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. And here, this deal of the century, which nobody knows what it is yet, but we do know that it's supposed to start with some kind of economic aid for the Palestinians. So if they don't accept it or participate in the conference, they're heading for another Nakba for sure. Having said that, I'll be back after the break. Hi, you're back with Jay Shapiro. A number of former commanders, pretty high ranking, of the Israeli army are demanding a referendum on the possible annexation of parts of the West Bank's Area C. Area C is that part which, according to the Oslo Agreement, it belongs to Israel. There's an Area A, there's an Area B, and there's an Area C. The C is supposed to be totally Israeli, A is totally Palestinian, and B is sort of a mixture. At any rate, these former commanders are upset about the possible annexation of parts of Area C. Right now, Area C is simply Area C. It hasn't been annexed by Israel. Now, you only have to consider the latest round of fighting in Gaza to understand what the threat would be to the cities of the coastal plain if Israel were to give up control of the mountainous terrain dominating the country's heartland. If you look at the map of Israel, there is a mountain range that runs right up the center, from south to north, roughly. For example, Jerusalem is in that mountain range. From that mountain range, you go down to the west to the Mediterranean Sea, and to the east, you go down toward the Jordan Valley, which is actually below sea level. So it is very important that Israel keep that mountain summit under its own control. Because if you go there and just look, you can see Tel Aviv, and you see most of Israel's economic, social, and industrial heartland. So only a few weeks ago, in the midst of the election campaign, and by the way, I think most of the listeners realize we're now going for another election, the second one this year, and I'll say a little bit more about that later, because after the first election, the prime minister was unable to put together a ruling coalition, which is a story unto itself, and I'll speak about hopefully later. Right now, I'm talking about the question of annexing parts of the West Bank. So as I started to say, in the midst of the election campaign, this group of former commanders inundated the country with billboards and posters all over, at the cost of millions of shekels, telling the voters that elections would spell the difference between separation from the Arabs and annexation. They were trying to help the side that said separation. You can see from the wording of the billboards. Now, it turns out that a considerable majority of the Israeli people chose to ignore the recommendations of these security experts. It included, by the way, three former chiefs of staff of the Israeli army. And these former chiefs of staffs are now running a political party that was sort of put together, patchwork. It's called the Blue and White Party. And they've enjoyed the open support of other retired chiefs of staff. And they managed to get public opinion on their side and achieve a large parliamentary group, which they would use to implement the recommendation of former senior defense officials who favor additional withdrawals from that land. So this controversy, if you analyze it, has two different aspects. The first aspect has to do with the overall vision of Israel and Israeli national security. As defined by the Israeli Defense Forces, there is a definition, and I quote, "National security is a domain concerned with ensuring the national capacity to contend effectively with any threat to the national existence and to national interest." Now, that is a great statement. Let me say that again. It's one sentence that says it all. National security is the domain concerned with ensuring the national capacity to contend effectively with any threat to the national existence and national interest. And the national security means, for example, back in 1967, Israel took the first step. Israel attacked the enemy that was threatening it. So if you want to contend effectively, means not only defending yourself, it could also mean initiating actions. But that's a general statement. But you have to realize something, that Israel's national interest in the area called the West Bank, the mountainous center part of the country, goes way beyond security needs alone. The same is true for the Palestinians. When Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, rejected President Trump's deal of the century, He said, and I quote, "The Palestinian problem cannot be turned into nothing more than an economic humanitarian problem." In other words, he's not interested in helping his own people. He doesn't see an economic humanitarian problem, probably because he himself and his family live quite well. But he sees the Palestinian problem as one of the existence of the state of Israel. Israel, for its part, shouldn't turn the Zionist dream of nothing more than the desire for a safe haven for persecuted Jews. There are two schools of thought that brought the state of Israel into existence. One school of thought said the Jews need a safe place to go. They even looked into parts of Africa, in Uganda, for example. But the more traditional Jews said, no, we only have one homeland, and that homeland is Eretz Israel. So Israel should not now look as the state of Israel is simply a safe haven for persecuted Jews. David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel, emphasized that security is only a means, not the goal. There is a substantial difference between a desire for security and a desire for independence, and therein lies the heart of the controversy. That's all about security. The second aspect of our controversy concerns the security issue itself. Over the years, the strategic outlook of those generals who headed the army has been unfortunately debunked time and again in the face of reality. Many of those former commanders who signed a letter to the prime minister about annexation also signed a declaration of support by the movement of peace and security, which pushed for a unilateral disengagement from Gaza back in 2005. They pushed for a unilateral disengagement, promising that it would improve Israel's security. Indeed, the disengagement took place, but they were obviously dead wrong. We know this now. Now, where do the commanders go wrong? They misunderstand the potential threat to Israel, resulting from, on the one hand, dramatic changes in the nature of war, and on the other hand, the vastly enhanced power and capabilities of the Palestinian terror organizations. This has happened since the launch of the peace process, the Oslo peace process. One need only consider the latest round of fighting in Gaza to understand the threat to the cities of Israel's coastal plain would look like if Israel were to give up control of the mountainous terrain dominating the country's economic, social, and industrial heartland. A rocket was fired from Gaza 2 or 3 weeks ago. It landed north of Tel Aviv. There's a highway runs north and south in Israel. It's a major highway called Highway 6. And if we gave up parts of the West Bank, Highway 6 would become a border road. And anti-tank and anti-aircraft missiles would threaten traffic on the main transportation arteries, as well as air traffic to Israel. The airport at Lod would be under the range of Palestinian artillery. So the outcome of the recent elections indicates that a considerable majority of Israelis have learned it for all their great respect for people who devoted days and nights to defending the country, these senior officers, it is wise to beware that their misconceived visions and recommendations. They're simply wrong. Now, since I mentioned Trump's deal of the century and Trump's peace plan, which is unknown at the moment, I want to say and make a few comments about it. There are those who will criticize any plan. There are a lot of people who don't like Trump viscerally, unfortunately, and anything he says they'll disagree with or they won't listen to. So there are those who will criticize any plan, no matter how positive it may be, if it comes from Trump. When Trump moved the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem a year ago, and recently he recognized Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights, many Democrats who would have favored such moves if they had been done by a Democratic president like Barack Obama, they opposed these moves only because the same moves were done by President Trump. These Democrats apparently do not want to see Trump succeed in anything, even if his success would be good for America, for Israel, and for peace. I watch the news. The American news that I watch is, we watch quite a bit of the American news, Fox News in particular, and the Democrats have seemingly, they've lost control of themselves. When I was a kid, everybody I knew voted Democratic. All the Jews are Democrats. Today, you look at the Democratic Party and they even have a radical left, and they have very open anti-Semites like these new Muslim members of Congress. So, you know, nobody ever lost money betting against peace between Israelis and Palestinians. However, there are opinions by what used to be prestigious newspapers. The New York Times seems to have determined to kill the proposed Trump Middle East peace plan before it's even made public. In a recent article, the New York Times, talking about the peace plan, only quoted those who were against it without it even having seen the plan. They're already saying that the plan will not work, although nobody has seen the plan, which is rather fascinating when you think about it. At any rate, the Times does analysis in their news section, which is really an editorial. This has become more and more common on the news pages of New York Times. The separation of news from opinion is in the highest tradition of journalism, but now it seems because of President Trump, the newspapers are breaking all their own rules, particularly when the subject is Israel. According to them, Israel can do no right and Donald Trump is always wrong. And when these two subjects come together, as they do with regard to the Trump peace plan, you have to be very wary of accepting news reports as being objective. Unfortunately, years ago, I remember the New York Times was the newspaper of note. It is no longer true. So that's unfortunate. It really is unfortunate. The published reports so far say that the peace plan is going to come in two steps. The first being economic incentives that could improve the lives of the Palestinians. So that's why they're having this meeting in Bahrain. The hope is that the Sunni Arab nations will see the virtues in the plan and will pressure the Palestinians to sit down and negotiate. In the meantime, the Palestinians aren't even going to show up. Now, right now, we don't know what kind of government we're going to have in Israel because we're about to go into another election on September 17th. So he would have formed a right-wing government if he would have formed a government at all in the last election. But I'm recording this program on Thursday night, and last night at midnight, the Knesset decided to go to new elections. The second elections costing millions of dollars in the same year. So even when President Trump moved the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, he recognized Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights, the Democrats simply refused to go along with it because they do not like him. So what's happening is, in many cases, the newspapers in the United States who don't like Trump refuse to separate opinion and analysis from hard reporting. So the hyper-partisan nature of politics in the United States and the media not being objective is very bad. The The danger of biased reporting is that it can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. If a newspaper, a prestigious newspaper like New York Times, reports that the plan will fail, even without having seen it, that report itself is likely to have influence on the parties to the negotiation. They read the New York Times. Nobody wants to risk their credibility by being part of a failed effort. So that's the way it is, and our prime minister was unable to form a right-wing government, and now we are going to new elections, and this is the whole. And if Trump comes up with the peace plan in this interim period, you don't know really how they're going to react to it here. Or in the United States. So, and another thing is happening on September 17th. We're going to have another election here in Israel. As I said, the second one this year. But at the same time, Labor Day, the beginning of September, I think it's the Monday after the first Sunday in September. Labor Day is traditionally the start of the presidential election campaign for the 2020 election. And this is going to affect how Trump's attitude toward the Middle East. It can't help but affect the politicians' attitude toward the Middle East, because right now there's something like 25 Democrats running for office. So I don't know who the Democratic candidate will end up being, but Israel is only one of the topics discussed by the candidates. So here we have Israel facing its own election, which is going to take place at the beginning of an American election period. And it really is a rather confusing issue. It really is. And our government has to maintain a bipartisan support in the United States. It's very important that there are people, for example, now who criticize our prime minister for being too friendly with President Trump. Because if Trump leaves office in 2020, the election, then and if we have been too closely associated with him, then we will be in trouble. So this is a very serious time, a very precarious time, and at least as far as Israel is concerned, we have to have politicians who see the long term, not just their immediate victory and their immediate hopes for gains in our election in September, but they have really looked very carefully at the possibility of losing a friend in the White House. So that will probably affect the Israeli election also. So there's never a dull moment. That's the way it is, for better or for worse. So having said that, I'll be back after the break. Hi, you're back with Jay Shapiro. This second segment of the program, I want to do what I like to call under the radar. These are items dealing with Israel, the Jewish people, that don't get the big headlines. They often get missed, but they add color to what's happening. So one of them, a great interest, I saw an article in the paper on Thursday, May 30th, and I want to share what it said because I found it very interesting. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who as a Republican congressman in 2017 was a strong vocal advocate of moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. These are the facts. Now, turned out that this week he presided over a ceremonial Florida cabinet meeting held at the Israel Embassy's Agron Street Annex in Jerusalem. There is an Agron Street Annex of the embassy. It's been there for many, many years. It's not the kind of a place like a consulate where you go in, you get passports and things like that. And there are American guards in front of it and also Israeli guards. And rumor has it, whenever you walk by, somebody will say, this is where the American spies hang out. So I don't know. But it's not a consulate where you go in and out to do passport or things like that. And anyhow, this meeting from the people from Florida was a four-person cabinet meeting, which included the Attorney General, the Commissioner of Agriculture, and the Chief Financial Officer. And all of this took place. Here's the interesting part. All this took place after a Florida judge dismissed efforts by the First Amendment Foundation and several news outlets to stop the meeting on the grounds that Florida laws mandate that cabinet meetings must be open and accessible to the public, something which is impossible if the meeting is held in Jerusalem, which is 6,000 miles away from Florida. The 45-minute meeting was actually live-streamed, including to a room in the capital of Florida in Tallahassee. The suit was filed against holding the meeting. The suits stated that due to embassy regulations, the public is prohibited from attending and media access is limited. In addition, it said that Florida citizens without valid passports cannot attend the meeting, and citizens of Palestinian, Arab, and or Muslim descent would have to travel have all kind of issues of access to Jerusalem. So what they claim was that holding a meeting at this distance in such a facility violates the constitutional and statutory rights of Florida citizens. They are entitled to personally observe the workings of and for the public to offer comment to their state's highest officials. So according to a report in the Florida Phoenix, Second Circuit Judge Angela Dempsey said on Tuesday that no action could be taken because the governor and the cabinet members who were out of the country could not be served with a summons. And so interestingly enough, the gathering marked the first time that a U.S. state's cabinet held a formal meeting in a U.S. embassy in Jerusalem. The embassy opened just last year, and they had all kind of resolutions, and they said Israel's the true friend of the United States, and it was very fascinating. They had discussions at this meeting on terrorism, water management, emergency response, DeSantis, the Florida governor, said at the outset of the meeting that the meeting was being held at the Agron Street Annex, which used to be the U.S. consulate building in Jerusalem because of construction taking place at the new embassy building in Arnona. And afterwards, the cabinet joined a 90-member Florida business and trade delegation where they signed into law an anti-Semitism bill passed recently by the Florida State Legislature following the shooting in California. So, very fascinating. We have a big friend, a good friend, and the governor of Florida, and apparently the entire Florida administration. They came here to spend money to make deals. And obviously, and of course, they made statements that that they're opposed to all the BDS and all the anti-Israel business boycotts. And DeSantis, the governor, said something very interesting, which I'll quote. He said the following. Here's the thing that frustrates me about BDS. He said that you have people who are willing to trade with Iran, which is the leading state sponsor of terrorism in the world, but they only want to boycott the one Jewish democracy in the world, which is the only place that they seem to get upset about. To me, this just shows that the anti-Semitism is driving the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement, and I don't think you can separate the two. So that the, by the way, earlier this year, the Florida cabinet became the first state cabinet in the U.S. to issue a proclamation recognizing Jerusalem, United Jerusalem, meaning both the eastern and the western parts of the city, as Jerusalem's eternal cabinet. So we have a friend in Florida, which is very nice to know. Now I want to switch to another subject, the fact that we're going to have an election on September 17th, the second election this year. Now, if the Knesset calls for a second election, which it did, It will cost the government 475 million shekels, according to a finance ministry official. Holding additional elections would harm the stability of businesses in Israel and the ease of doing business. The international high-tech world, which sees Israel as a global leader in the area, will see going to elections as a farce. So the special Knesset committee meeting took place after the legislature passed the bill, and they prepared legislation for a second bill, and it passed, and sure enough, we're going to have elections. And as I said, it's very unusual. Perhaps in the old days, right after the Second World War, I think it was the Italian government, they kept rising and falling every couple months. Now Israel is going to go through the same thing. It turned out that our prime minister attempted to bridge the gaps between potential coalition partners, in particular Yisrael Beiteinu, which is run by Avigdor Lieberman, and he's very anti-religion, and the United Torah Judaism is a ultra-Orthodox, and the argument was over enlistment in the Israeli army. No, nobody really won this election, but it turned out that they couldn't avoid it. It would just be impossible. Nobody wanted the compromise. So it turns out that the parties borrowed money from the government for the election which just occurred, and they owe money. So the campaign finance, the parties have yet to pay back the loans that were backed by the Knesset, Israeli parliament. The loans were taken for the election that took place less than 2 months ago. So the members of the Knesset asked that payments on their loans from the first election this year, the payment should be delayed until after the second election. Right now, the law currently states that a party cannot take out a new loan if they haven't paid the previous one. Now, interestingly enough, the parties currently have a total of 62 million shekels in debts. The Likud owes 36 million, that's the highest number, and United Arab List owes the least. They owe 1 million Israeli shekels. So it's interesting. They had a law that you can't borrow money again until you paid off the money from the previous election. But nobody expected the two elections to take place only a few months apart. So that's the situation we're up against now here in Israel. Israel, you know, it's funny, Israel's like a high-tech country, and Israel's a country that does all kind of things on the front line and on the frontier of science. Now Israel's in the front line of messing up elections, and how much of it has to do with principle, it's hard to know. Many years ago, I heard the Speaker of the House of Representatives of the state of Pennsylvania. I attended a meeting with him and a group of people who were pushing for state aid for religious education. And without going into all the details of the meeting, this person who was actually the Speaker of the House in Pennsylvania quoted Abraham Lincoln. He said, Abraham Lincoln was once asked, do you vote according to the dictates of your conscience? And Abraham Lincoln allegedly said, I vote according to the dictates of my conscience 10% of the time. So they said to him, boy, that's an awfully small number. How do you justify that? And he said, if I didn't vote against the dictates of my conscience 90% of the time, I wouldn't have an opportunity to vote with my conscience 10% of the time. And unfortunately, there are people here in Israel, the politicians, haven't learned that lesson from Lincoln. You can't always get what you want. And because of the stubbornness of what particular party, or the leader of that party, Lieberman, the party holds, I think, six seats. out of 120 seats in the Knesset, but that party is needed for a proper coalition to govern. And they refuse to go along, they refuse to compromise, and now this is going to cost the taxpayer and the government and the state millions and millions of shekels. And that is very, very tragic. It really is. A lot of ancient civilizations lived here in Palestine, and it's a wonderland for archaeologists. And they dig up all kinds of things that are of interest. But last week, there was a report of something absolutely, really a breakthrough. And it has to do with beer. Now, beer is a beverage that has been consumed for generations. It's a low-alcohol drink. It's made from yeast that is enjoyed. We enjoy beer all the time. But did you know that beer was even consumed thousands of years ago by the pharaohs, the ancient kings, and even perhaps some leaders of the Jewish people? So the question is, how different was that ancient beer to the kind that we drink today? What did it taste like? Well, it turns out that a group of researchers from the School of Dental Medicine at Hebrew University have examined the colonies of yeast that formed and settled in pottery that were used to produce ancient beer. What they did was, they have found pottery. It's quite common here in Israel to find ancient pottery. And they studied the pottery. They studied something called nanopores. I'm not sure what that is. Now, it turned out that they found that these 5,000-year-old yeast cultures are similar to those used in traditional African brews like honey wine and modern yeast to beer. So they tested it out. They got all kind of experts. They got certified tasters from the International Beer Judge Certification Program, and they tested it out. And the group all agreed that this beer that they made using this yeast that they found in the old pottery was a delicious beer of high quality and safe for consumption. By the way, the beer isn't bad, and aside from the gimmick of drinking beer from the time of King Pharaoh, the research is extremely important to the field of experimental archaeology, which is a field that seeks to reconstruct the past. The research offers all kind of new tools to examine ancient methods and enables researchers to taste the flavors of the past, actually the same flavors. So these findings paint a portrait that supports the biblical image of drunken Philistines, according to one of the experts on Land of Israel studies in archaeology. And they said it's a real breakthrough. This is the first time they succeeded in producing ancient alcohol from ancient yeast. In other words, from the original substance from which the alcohol was produced. This is something that has never been done before, and it is a breakthrough. And when I say there are things that I want the listeners to know that are under the radar, this is about as far under the radar you can get. Taking ancient yeast and reproducing ancient beer and then tasting it and saying it ain't bad. Very fascinating. One can only envy the archaeologists as they sat around probably drinking their 5,000-year-old beer with modern pretzels. This next item has to do with the fact that this program is going to be aired on Sunday, which is Jerusalem Day, the day that the Israeli army captured all of Jerusalem in the 1967 war. So I want to say something, not just about that war, but the situation we are in today. When the State of Israel came into being, there was a population of only 800,000. The country has grown more than tenfold. 31,000 people immigrated to Israel just last year, and there were a record 4.4 million tourists and visitors. I live near the heart of Jerusalem. There's near several hotels, and there are tourist buses day and night in this area. And Israel, Israelis regularly describe themselves among the happiest populations in the world, despite being in a situation with massive rocket fire from terrorist organizations in Gaza. And Israel is continuing to be one of the greatest arms exporters in the world. Exporting arms, you know, we would rather export education, academic research, but it's a question of national self-sufficiency. And it's seen this country play a central role in the world economy. And we are a very small state, so that is a rather unique position. And our technology, for instance, allowed us to withstand 700 rockets fired from Gaza in one day, and we can resist calls for revenge or invading the strip of land where so many Israelis have fought and died in the past. We don't want to go into Gaza. And the nice thing about our arms today is we have developed pinpoint accuracy, which allows weapons to strike terrorists and often not harm civilians. I don't want to call them humane weapons, but these are the facts. So we're celebrating the return of Jewish sovereignty to the ancient Jewish capital. I feel privileged that I live here. I'm within a few minutes' walk from the old city. I look out the front porch. I can see the windmill put up by Montefiore almost 200 years ago. And we have to realize that we are actually living in miraculous times. At least I think so. So, again, there's going to be another segment to this program, but I wanted to make sure to get in something about Jerusalem Day. When you stop and think about it for a minute, after almost 2,000 years of exile, we're back in David's capital. That's a wonderful thing. I'll be back after the break.